Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
From NHPR, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott.
First, you get the buckets ready, clean the pans, and gather firewood late in the winter. It's maple syrup time.
After years of record high temperatures, sugar houses across New England are waiting out this winter's deep freeze and crossing their fingers that it will make for plenty of sap. Sugaring is one of the nation's oldest agricultural crafts and is now a multi-billion-dollar business, shadowed by cutthroat competition, sap heists, charges of tree doping to increase yield, and a federation that influences the international market. That's what operations like Bascom Farms in Acworth, New Hampshire are up against. Bascom is one of the largest producers of pure maple syrup in New England, making up to 80,000 gallons of sap a day, a mind-boggling number that got the attention of the writer Douglas Wynot. He decided to follow the Bascom family to get a better understanding of the maple syrup industry, and his new book is called The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. Douglas Wynot, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
So I learned a lot in this book, plenty, one of which was that the maple syrup industry peaked around the time of the Civil War. Now, why was that?
Well, at that time, a lot of people were making maple sugar. It was a dry sugar that they used as a staple. And also, there was a political movement in this country that was called No Sugar Made by Slaves. It was an abolitionist feeling, especially in Vermont, I've read. And going back in history, Thomas Jefferson spearheaded a movement of self-sufficiency in this country to produce maple sugar in order to compete against the sugar industry in the Caribbean. It was the peak of the maple sugar industry, and it went steadily down from the 1860s until the 1960s. When Bruce Bascom began to produce maple syrup use plastic tubing instead of buckets.
Bascom's family made a transition from dairy farming into the maple business and has since grown this huge empire. Mm-hmm. Give us a little sense about how that evolved.
Well, when Bruce was a boy in the 50s and 60s, he worked alongside his dad, tapping trees, putting in spouts, hanging a bucket on the spout. The sap would go drip, 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 and they would empty a bucket every couple of days, a couple of gallons. And Ken Bascom decided that he would sell his dairy herd that his father had begun and that he had developed to 80 animals. And it was a big risk. It was a big leap for him to do that during that time. No one where he lived in that part of New Hampshire had ever gone into the endeavor of making maple syrup full-time. Well, this happened when Bruce was a teenager. He was about 13, 14 years old. And Bruce decided then that someday he would try to make a living making maple syrup. So he went to UNH. His father and his uncles had all gone to the ag school, but Bruce went to the business school. And for his senior project in an entrepreneurial marketing course, management course, he designed a project in which there would be 25,000 taps on plastic tubing all feeding into a central sugar house. And that was kind of a revolutionary idea. And at the time, people didn't believe that that would be possible. Bruce's classmates kind of made fun of him, called it the flubbing tubing product. He went to the bank the next year. The bankers refused to lend him money to do this. But his father talked to the bankers, and he went back, and he got the money for the tubing. And Bruce, along with Peter Rhodes and a cousin, eventually set up the largest tubing system in New England and became the largest producers of maple syrup in New England within about a decade. And Bruce is a real energetic go-getter type of guy. So he just started adding on and adding on and adding on. As a matter of fact, his first year back from college, he went around knocking on doors and asking if he could rent trees from his neighbors. He rented one tree, you know, many, many trees at 10 cents per tap and gathered, as a result, gathered so much syrup that he overwhelmed his dad. That was kind of the beginning of what became the biggest producer in New England and remains the biggest producer in New Hampshire, Bascom Maple Farms makes about one quarter of all the maple syrup in New Hampshire.
And how does it stack up in competition with the fake maple syrup, you know, the Mrs. Butterworths and Aunt Jemimas that we see in supermarkets and on tables all over the place?
Yeah, well, that's their problem. I mean, they're always up against the artificials. That is an $18 billion industry with syrups made from high fructose corn syrup and artificial caramel color and then a flavor derived from the fenugreek plant. I asked Bruce recently what the average consumption of maple syrup was in this country, and he said per person it's about 3 ounces.
Wow. I guess he wants to get that number up.
I guess he does.
Now, wait, you mentioned an $18 billion market. How much is the pure maple syrup market?
I heard it's $800
million. Oh, wow. So just a fraction.
Yeah. So it's under a billion, and you know, that was the number that Bruce gave me. So it's very small.
We're getting schooled in maple syrup with Douglas Wynot. He's got a new book out called The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. For his research, he followed Bascom Farms in Acworth, New Hampshire, in their operations day in and day out for a couple of years to get a sense of the industry, which is a multi-million dollar industry, and it also has its kind of shadowy side. Last year, we reported on a maple syrup heist in a town just north of Montreal. 6 million pounds of maple syrup worth about $18 million wholesale, stolen from a warehouse. Doug, what does this reveal about the underbelly, the black market operating in the maple syrup industry?
Well, that was all based in Quebec, where there is a huge maple syrup industry. And most of the commercial producers, or all of the commercial producers in Quebec, are members of an organization called the Quebec Federation of Maple Syrup Producers. It has a French name. The federation controls the bulk sales of maple syrup. And they also, starting in 2002, started what they call the Global Strategic Reserve of Maple Syrup, most commonly called the surplus. And they began to set aside a certain amount of syrup to provide supply in case there was a shortage.
So like federal strategic oil reserves or something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly, wow. Like that. It's the same thing. So after they started the surplus, there were a few years where there were big crops and they had in their supply a whole year's worth of crop. And so as a result, the Federation established quotas and there were some serious conflicts as a result of that, and there were threats, and the president's sugar house was burned down. But it proved to be right, because between the years of 2006, 2007, 2008, there were some winters that were extended winters where it was very, very cold, and then it suddenly turned to spring, and the crops were way down. And as a result, there was a supply available from the Federation to sell to the supermarkets and to put on the shelves. So anyway, in 2011 into 2012, a group of people in Quebec went into one of the Federation warehouses and began emptying barrels. They filled some of the barrels with water and left some of them empty. On July 30th, 2012, an auditor went into this warehouse. It was a rented warehouse. The Federation was building a third warehouse for the supply, the surplus. And the auditor went in and discovered that there was water in one of the barrels and there were some empty barrels. So an investigation began, and eventually arrests were made. It was a lot of syrup, 6 million pounds, 8,000 barrels, $20 million worth, so a significant amount. And that syrup kind of gradually bled into the market before the discovery of the theft. So this syrup was just sort of circulating into the market before anyone knew about this. The arrests were made at the end of 2012, I think it was 20, 23 people were charged and arrested, and the trials still are
who was behind him? Were these just like hired guns or what?
Well, it was various people in Quebec who were opposed to the Federation and the control of the Federation, and who were trading in black market syrup, say, before the stolen syrup came onto the market. I mean, when I talked to the director of the Federation, I asked her, I said, is there a black market? And she said, well, that's human nature.
Well, you're getting to something that's so interesting that comes across in the book. You know, we have this kind of maple syrup seems like one of the most wholesome things that you can possibly imagine, you know, tapping a tree, running a line into your barn. And it's really such a different thing. Bruce Bascom is tearing his hair out or trying to keep his stride half the time, figuring out how to balance the supply that's down in his cellar with what he's putting out in the market. You spoke to several owners of sugar houses that are so worried about, you know, will they have enough? Will they have too much? And this is all dependent on nature.
It is.
In order for these operations to survive in the future, what kind of technologies are they going to have to embrace?
You may remember that in 2012, it got up into the 80s, and for 10 days, temperatures were above freezing. What I discovered and what sugar makers discovered was that during this warm year, when sap was coming out of the trees at times like jelly or cottage cheese was what David Marvin described to me and other sugar makers because it was so hot, they found that they could still gather sap by using vacuum systems. Long after the people using buckets and who are on what is called on gravity, long after they're finished, people on tubing with advanced vacuum systems can keep making syrup. And Bascom's has been able to do that. They were able to produce a decent crop in 2012 when other producers had, you know, a 10% or 20% crop. So,
well, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Really
nice
appreciate
to talk
it.
To you.
Douglas Wynot's new book is called The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. We do have more information on the book. He is also the author of A Unit of Water, A Unit of Time, Giant Bluefin, and he teaches writing at Boston's Emerson College and lives right here in Langdon, New Hampshire. Well, after the interview, we asked Douglas to stick around for a sticky challenge, a blind maple syrup taste test. The aim was to test his ability to distinguish between the various grades of maple syrup. So we sat down with five cups. Three were filled with varieties of grade A, light, medium, and dark. There was also a cup with grade B syrup, which has a stronger maple flavor and has traditionally been used for cooking. And of course, the Ringer, a brand name artificial syrup. And because you can tell a lot by the color of syrup, both Douglas and I donned blindfolds for the occasion. Well, not blindfolds exactly. Our producers tied one of my scarves around Douglas's head, and I wore an Elmer Fudd hat over my eyes to prevent any accidental or intentional cheating. So I'm starting?
Yep. Yeah, you go first. Did you miss?
I hit the microphone. I'm thinking that's a grade A.
I'm thinking it's close to that. It's somewhere in the middle.
Maybe an amber.
Yeah, it doesn't have that strongish bite, but there's a lot of flavor. Maybe it's an amber.
You know, what are you looking for when you're tasting the syrup?
Sometimes it's the texture of the syrup, but I'm looking for that burst of the maple flavor that comes after it moves into your mouth, kind of spreads out over your tongue, and pops.
This smells much, much
Let's
stronger.
Not get distracted. Oh, it moves so slowly.
Mm-hmm. This feels like the flavor is out in front and the scent is out in front. You know, there's no subtlety there.
Right. Maybe I'll say that's the artificial. Well, when I was a kid, Vermont Made and those other syrups had 2% maple syrup. And it had come down from 15% originally, and then I think it went down to 8 or so, somewhere in that area, and then down to 2. And then one of the brands eliminated maple syrup and went totally artificial and gained in market share.
No kidding.
And that was devastating for the industry at that time. That was in the 60s.
All right, here you go. This is a really nice one. It's very, it feels darker to me. It feels like it has
yes.
a sort of heavier bottom.
Yes, it has a heavier bottom. That's a real strong maple flavor. To me, that's the best.
One of those back-of-mouth flavors, too.
And vanillin is one of the most dominant flavor precursor in maple syrup. And so I would say there's definitely a presence of the vanillin taste in that syrup.
Maybe it's grade B?
That's what I wrote,
that's
grade
what
B. Some people used to say that grade B was for cooking, but I talked to a syrup producer who has an account in Cambridge at a restaurant, and he said that when the waitresses served grade B syrup, they got higher tips.
No kidding.
And he would bring lighter syrup to them. They would complain.
Oh, that's got a nice flavor. It's thinner.
There's something else in this.
I don't taste as much of the vanillin that you mentioned.
No, there's something else. It's so hard to come up with adjectives for the actual flavors, but this has something
it's
more...
warmer.
Warmer, it's... yeah. Orangey almost. Huh.
Mm, that's also delicious.
That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That moves differently, too, across your mouth.
It does. What is that? What is that quality? Is that just how much they boil it?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, they boil it to come to 66 or 67%. Maybe it moved a little bit beyond that, 68 or something. We're feeling that as it moves. But this is it feels lighter, but the flavor is sort of a centrality to the maple flavor. I'm going to try that again.
That was Douglas Wynot, professor of writing at Emerson College and author of a new book about the maple syrup industry and a family who makes it. After we tasted all five of the maple syrup varieties, we took off our blindfolds and checked to see how accurate we were. Of course, there was only one cup we really wanted to be able to tell from the rest.
All right, this is our moment of truth.
This is the...
fake number two.
As long as we got the fake.
That's the important thing.
Here's to us.
Thank you very much. That was a lot of fun.
Thanks to Douglas for being such a good sport. You can watch a video of our somewhat comical blind taste test at wordofmouthradio.org. You'll also find details to hear Douglas talk about his book. He'll be at Gibson's Bookstore on Tuesday, April 2nd. There's more on the event, the book, the sugar season, and a link to watch that video at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for spending a little bit of your weekend with Word of Mouth. If you do like what you heard, there's much more to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us. You can send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more on Monday at noon, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.